All right. It's time for your shot. Questions from the audience, from our panelists? A lot of information. If you're not overwhelmed, I'm sure you've got some great questions. Yes, right here front.
Nobody from the panelists mentioned anything about the relationship between...
Here, I know.
Nobody from the panelists mentioned anything about the relationship between brain disorders and the vasculature of the brain. Would anybody comment on that?
Darrell, I think this one's in your court to start.
Thanks for the easy one.
Well, the one example I know in the ophthalmology area is a great example of vasculature affecting neuronal integrity, retinal cells, and diabetic retinopathy is one example. That's interesting. I guess stroke area would be another area. Stroke area has probably been, I was just thinking of Doug's talk, has been the hardest area to work in, basically, and it's littered with probably the most failure in the CNS area. And then there's a fundamental maybe with new imaging techniques that actually measure blood flow and other aspects of function in disease. And with drugs, maybe we could understand more about how vascular function affects brain function. And that's a pretty nascent area, and how that relates to the diseases that we talked about. So maybe that's something to think about, basically, as that area matures.
Other question? Yes, up in the back. Yeah? Speak up loudly, Sal. I'm not going to walk.
My question is for Darrell. A few years ago, you present wonderful data at the APA on the metabotropic glutamate receptors. What is the current status of this metabotropic glutamate receptor ligand, in the area of antipsychotics and neuropathic pain?
You don't have any notes with you.
I guess I don't work at Eli Lilly anymore, so I really can't represent what they're doing. I think the fundamental discovery in this proof of concept study is that these drugs basically can control symptoms in disease patients such as schizophrenia. So they meet those criteria I talked about. So a glutamate mechanism. So glutamate's involved in many diseases. And glutamate imbalance is involved in all these diseases, including schizophrenia. And it showed that you could basically take a glutamate mechanism through the metabotropic, and you could affect pathophysiology and not physiology. And that's what metabotropic receptors, I think, are good for. And actually, there's many examples. Actually, another good example is in Parkinson's. We signed a deal with Addex Pharmaceuticals. Actually, it was based on some really nice research that was done at Merck before I arrived by Jeff Kahn, where it's a real fundamental understanding of how hyperglutamate function exists in dopamine-depleted Parkinson patients, and how that you might be able to, by controlling glutamate, normalize symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And we signed a collaboration with Addex to look at, and these were mGlu4 receptor modulator. So that's a really good hypothesis to test, which needs a ligand thrown at. So I think it's the principle, which is exciting, that you can find ways through this neurotransmitter. And there are many examples of other neurotransmitters which are promising. Well, there's new CGRP. Merck's working on CGRP platform for migraine. There's orexins in the sleep area, the GSK, Actillion, others, that type of biology. There's just a lot of good examples, I think, of where there are good new drug targets. And maybe in some of these areas, maybe there won't be the kind of failure that we've experienced in the past.
Question?
Doug, the IPO market. Gone for good. We'll be back for this environment. Has the world changed?
These are
not
working.
Yeah, that's a pretty existential question for my business. I think IPOs are going to come back. The question is going to be whether the biotech IPO is going to come back. There's always going to be a place for profitable revenue-generating companies in the public market, but whether a biotech company with a couple drugs in clinical trials and maybe a partnership is going to be something that is going to trade at a reasonable valuation on the public markets, I think that's questionable. And I think there's probably going to be a shift in how biotech companies towards a fewer and bigger kind of model. At least for IPOs, what we've seen in this decade is a much more active acquisition process by the big pharmas. And they're fine with the smaller companies. That's a lot easier to swallow. So it's going to be challenging. I don't think IPOs are going to come back the way they have before.
So liquidity will be more through acquisition?
Yeah, or we're going to stop doing this.
Questions? Yeah, up in the back.
Do you know whether the entire VC space has been net negative in the neuro space for the past few or several rounds, or whether that's just been your experience?
Well, how do you benchmark yourself there, Doug?
I don't know. And I'm sure it depends a little bit on what you define as a neuro company. There have certainly been some very successful company, Xenoport comes to mind, delivering gabapentin a little bit differently. There have been some non-venture deals, but relatively small companies that have been very successful in the space. Endo, for example, or Cephalon, New River would be another one. There have been several substantial winners in the space. You know, it may be that biotech as a whole is a net negative.
Yeah.
So it's likely that neuro's a net negative too.
Good. Question, yes?
With regards to the collaborations that you're emphasizing, which is great, anybody had any luck with the FDA, getting them to sit down at the table and discuss what it's going to take to get them to actually approve something in a more transparent sense? And maybe Todd, that you all had to meet with them fairly recently. Any luck?
I mean, our experience has been a lot that they will talk in generalities, and they want to know, like, once there's a specific drug, then they'll make the decision. But in terms of at least of Parkinson's disease, for the disease modification label, at the meeting that we had, they did give some pretty specific guidance that for that label, they would want to have a biological outcome in addition to just the clinical. And it was interesting at the meeting because we also had the EMEA, which had a different take on that that question. So there wasn't agreement within the regulatory agencies, and the impression from that meeting was that the EMEA was kind of trying to be more creative in ways that they would address these issues than the FDA. But that was just in that one instance. I don't know if other experiences people have had.
There are a couple areas where the FDA has been very collaborative. It's there's still a show me with the data, which I guess maybe is a good thing. I don't know. But that's in the area of schizophrenia around the matrix, basically clinical instruments for cognition, neurocognition deficits in schizophrenia. Been very collaborative around that. In the area of Alzheimer's biomarkers, they've been very collaborative. And I don't know if you've seen some of the recent press and people have been engaging them, and I think they've been reasonably collaborative in that area. Maybe Parkinson's is probably a little behind in that.
Yeah, I mean, there's one thing that the FDA has done for Parkinson's disease that is very interesting and could be beneficial is they've gone back to some of the placebo arms of some of the disease-modifying trials, and they've now been data mining that to try to get a better understanding of the disease progression, since there have been some relatively large scales, at least for Parkinson's, trials that have gone to the FDA. And they presented that at the meeting to get a better sense for what the natural history of the disease may be to set as a threshold to go after for new therapies. So I do think they are wanting to get involved to an extent at least.
Another question? Yes, up in the back.
I was wondering if the panel could comment on the role of diagnostics, especially early diagnostics, for a lot of these diseases in the success or failures for a lot of these therapeutics that are coming out, especially in Alzheimer's. There's, you know, over 700 molecules that are in some sort of clinical trials. All of them pretty much failed one after the other. And a lot of the focus has been on early diagnostics, but it doesn't seem like there's been a lot of companies or pharmaceuticals kind of develop those kind of
Yeah, I don't know who feels most comfortable. Todd, yeah. You want to take a first shot?
Yeah, I know this is a big issue, I think, particularly for the development of a disease-modifying therapy for a lot of these neurodegenerative diseases, because I know, just speaking for Parkinson's disease, that when people come with the symptoms of the disease, there's already been a very significant loss of the neurons. So it's about 80% loss, 50 to 80% loss of the neurons by the time they're diagnosed. So depending on your neuroprotective strategy, that may be too late to have an effect if some process has already started. And there is a large study for Parkinson's being funded by the Department of Defense to try to identify what they're referring to as premotor Parkinson's. So is there a way to find people almost before they've expressed the motor symptoms that are, because presumably neuronal dysfunction is already happening in the brains of those individuals. Those are very difficult studies to do, to actually find people before they have a disease that in itself is hard to diagnose. So I think, but I do think it's an important challenge. And this is where Daryl talked about neuroimaging, and developing the right neuroimaging ligands might actually be a path to identify people that are at the very early stages of some of these diseases.
Yeah, I think what Todd said about neurodegenerative disease is probably true for all of them. That I know it's for ALS and for Alzheimer's, it's Parkinson's. By the time the disease is clinically manifest, the pathology is very pretty much underway, and there's a lot of neuronal damage that the brain is compensated for. In the Alzheimer's area, it's in the form of mild cognitive impairments, where you basically is the first sign, and then you have to understand, and then that could be caused by many things, and you don't know, is it really somebody that has Alzheimer's is why they have early cognitive impairment. If you had imaging agents that can actually measure amyloid load, and then genetics, where you have risk factors like APOE4, then you could select out those patients early.
Mm-hmm. This question right here. Mm-hmm.
So follow on to that previous question about genotyping, and maybe this is particularly for Daryl, but in like both your thoughts. Do you think that advances in genomics are going to change the drug discovery process for these more common diseases with multigenic, multifactorial genetic causes, for example, by stratifying patient populations, allowing you to reduce the variability or reduce the sample size? How much of an impact is that going to have?
Well, I guess what I'd say it's the impact is unknown, basically. You know, we bought Rosetta, and we do molecular profiling, and we're doing some very interesting experiments. A lot of that is targeted in oncology. But in the neuroscience area, it's very difficult to connect the gene to the disease, and particularly in the psychiatric illnesses. And it's not clear, you know, I think some of the data that's coming out, it's just not clear how, you know, maybe even what you get, you know, the drug, potential drug targets that come out of that. But it's not yet clear how you translate that even into drug targets when there's so many genes contributing to the etiology. So it's just not clear. In some area, I think it does, it's interesting and it does help, and it's early days. And the technology is there now, in a way that was never there. So it's early days, and I would say it's kind of unproven, and it's probably a high hurdle in psychiatric disease.
Mm-hmm. Todd?
Yeah, we've actually been thinking about this a lot recently in Parkinson's disease, because it's very clear from the data that there are multiple causes of Parkinson's disease, some of which are genetic and some which can be on the full spectrum of environmental. And just recently, in the last couple of years, there was one gene, LRRK2, that was discovered that may account for 1 to 2% of all of Parkinson's disease, which, if you sectioned that amount of patients, it would be a very, very small number of total patients, more like Huntington's disease in terms of the patient size. But is that population going to be treated better by a LRRK2-based therapy? And would a LRRK2-based therapy apply to broadly to Parkinson's disease? So it's not known now, but it's something that I think we're going to be thinking about in Parkinson's as more of these genes are discovered that only account for small subsets of the population.
And with the rapidly decreasing cost of sequence and genotype information, the kind of data that's going to get produced over the next few years is most likely to impact choice of pharmaceutical for the patient rather than help bring new pharmaceuticals forward. So it may be for when there are a number of options that are used by the community, it may be easier to hook up a patient with the drug that will work best for that individual more quickly based on a genetic profile. But I think it's going to be a long time before, if ever, before that sort of genetic data translates into new therapies.
Time for one last question.
Yep.
Yes, go ahead.
So how far into the future might you think our regenerative medicine approaches, like growth factors and stem cells for nervous system disorders?
Who wants to take that one on?
I know, Todd, I know
you have an opinion
on
this.
For Parkinson's disease, growth factors right now have been already tested in phase 2 trials, and there's actually a phase 2 trial now for a gene therapy approach for a neurotrophic factor. And the results of that will be known in the next couple of months on how that phase 2 trial went. So growth factors could be very on the far end of being close if that trial works. Stem cells, I think, are on the other end in terms of the horizon. There's a lot of very interesting science going on and coercing embryonic stem cells into dopamine-producing neurons has been very successful in a culture dish. But how to actually transfer that and translate that into a real treatment, I think, is still a ways off.
So. Anybody else want to offer a thought on that?
Sure. On the stem cell front, we spend a lot of time trying to think through where stem cells are likely to succeed first and what are the hurdles so we can intelligently invest. And I think a couple of the initial applications are likely to be in the neuro space, actually, but if they would fall into the orphan disease category and not into the broader,
neurodegenerative,
like neurodegeneration.
Yeah.
On the growth factor front, I think I had a term sheet down on the company you were talking about, but I got outbid. so it was one of those mechanisms we were willing to bet on.
Yeah. Great. Still may get another shot. Good. Well, I'd like to thank the panel for just a great discussion. This is really wonderful. And good job. And let me turn it back to Pearl for a couple of final comments and finish off.
One last thank you for our speakers this evening for insightful and thought-provoking presentations. Daryl Shep, Doug Fambro, Skip Irving, Todd Shearer, and Chris Adams. And for more information about the MIT Enterprise Forum of Cambridge, please see our website, mitforumcambridge.org. If you're interested in membership, you'll find information there. And as I mentioned, our next program will be December 3rd, focused on water technologies. And we hope some of you will come back for that program. So now, please join.